Hello.
The last time I spoke about the processes through which Egypt was unified, approximately 5,000 years ago, and about the archaeological questions and the historical questions about how that process actually happened. What was the set of developments that resulted in this large, unified territorial state? Was this unification of Egypt a sudden event associated with the conquest of Lower Egypt, the kingdom of Lower Egypt, by Upper Egypt? Essentially, one state defeating another and incorporating it to form a single large territorial political unit? This is the traditional view. It's centered on the actions of Narmer the king, a culture hero, if you like, the first great conqueror, the first real individual in Egyptian history. Or was it, on the other hand, possibly a more gradual and piecemeal process? If we think about the available data, archaeological data, particularly on Lower Egypt, it really doesn't seem to have been a state at all. The Nile Delta particularly seems to have been an area with relatively low levels of political centralization and social hierarchy, even at the end of the pre-dynastic period. After the early dynastic period, then there's this period of stabilization, I suppose, if you like, amalgamation and consolidation of the Egyptian state. This early dynastic period lasts from about 3100 to 2680 BC. After that period, Egyptian history is traditionally divided into the Old Kingdom, which lasts until about 2134 BC, the Middle Kingdom, which extends from about 2040 BC to 1640 BC, about 400 years, and the New Kingdom, which dates from about 1570 to 1070 BC, approximately 500 years. So these three Old, Middle, and New Kingdoms, with short intermediate periods of disunity and lack of political control, lack of centralized political control between each and after the New Kingdom. You may guess from the relative precision of these dates that they are not actually derived from archaeological research. Our radiocarbon dates usually have some degree of uncertainty associated with them. So we're not going to give dates like 1640 BC, for example. These chronologies are historical ones, derived from analysis of lists of rulers of the Egyptian state, pharaohs, written at various times during and after the period of Egyptian rule. These historical periods, the Old, Middle, and New Kingdoms, and the intermediate periods, are further divided into dynasties, which are, theoretically at least, families of related rulers. I'm going to talk later about this extraordinary continuity, this political continuity, which is really quite remarkable in Egypt, and its contrasts with Mesopotamia. But I will just note here, we can say in general that through the 3rd and 2nd millennia BC, Mesopotamia was generally characterized, or more usually characterized, by the dispersal of political power among relatively smaller political units. Individual city-states, for example, during the 3rd and early mid 2nd millennium BC. While over the same period, Egypt is generally or usually characterized by the centralization of political authority in a single territorial state. This is really quite extraordinary centralization and continuity as well. The 30th dynasty, the last dynasty in this long period of Egyptian rule, ended only in the 4th century BC, after more than 2,500 years. And even after that, later rulers of Egypt, background sometimes Macedonian, felt the necessity to maintain at least some of the forms of classical Egyptian rule for centuries after that, centuries longer. So there's this tremendous, if you like, success displayed by a political system that was being established approximately 3000 BC. Extension and consolidation of state control then in Egypt. From the Nile Delta in the north to the cataracts beyond Aswan in the south, took place gradually after 3000 BC and was probably more or less complete by the end of the early dynastic period around 2700 BC. This stretch of the Nile provided the territorial core of the Egyptian state. The state would expand at some points over the next 2500 years, to the south, for example, along the Nile. And for Africanist archaeologists like me, one really interesting issue is always the nature of Egyptian contacts further to the south, along the Nile, and into the deserts on both sides of the Nile. Because remember, one issue here is that as we go further south into Sudan, what's now the modern country of Sudan, we're actually getting into areas that are somewhat less arid on either sides of the Nile than is the case in Egypt. So there's more possibilities for contacts, for productive trade, for example, away from the river. We do know that there were parallel developments towards political centralization and state formation along the Nile in Sudan to the south of the Egyptian state. Much of this was actually happening in very early times in the 3rd millennium BC, for example, at places like Kerma. So we concentrate on Egypt, but we shouldn't lose track of the fact that similar sorts of processes on a smaller scale were happening in other areas further to the south along the Nile as well. German archaeologists have done fascinating research in areas now desert, including some of the regions where the modern borders of Egypt, Libya, Chad, and Sudan join up, looking at trading systems that far away from the Nile, or at least trading routes that far away from the Nile. And as we are going to see later on, there are interesting issues about relationships between Egypt and developing state-level societies on the Ethiopian plateau as well. So we have these interesting connections to the south, as well as along the Mediterranean coast and into the area of the Levant, the lands to the east of the Mediterranean. The core along the Nile of the Egyptian state remained culturally and ethnically Egyptian. Egypt was generally monolingual and monocultural, albeit with some differences in practices and beliefs inherited from the pre-dynastic period that would just become less marked as time went on. There was certainly some borrowing of elite practices and iconography, especially, as I said, further south along the Nile in what is now Sudan. This is not surprising, given the continuing extension of the river to the north and south. But these people beyond the borders remained and were seen by Egyptians as very different from themselves. Thus, for example, just to give one example, the 25th dynasty of Egypt is actually Sudanese. It came from the area called Kush in what's now modern Sudan in the early 1st millennium BC. and actually ruled Egypt, but ruled very much as an Egyptian dynasty with Egyptian elite practices and assumptions. An administrative system was imposed along the Nile fairly early in the development of the Egyptian state. It was probably based on the territories of the pre-dynastic chiefdoms that were arrayed, as I put it at one point, like beads on a string along the river. These provinces would be known as nomes. And during periods of political instability, governance would in some cases devolve back to the nome level at times when the central political authority in Egypt broke down. For example, at certain times during the intermediate periods, when centralized rule failed, localized governors, chiefs would increase in authority. For the most part, though, when that political control did exist, this territorial administration was controlled directly from the court of the pharaoh, initially at Memphis, to provide the institutional supports for such an extensive and centralized system of territorial governance and the propaganda needed for elite rule. A literate bureaucracy developed. And we really need to think about this. The requirements for administration along the Nile were very different than in the Mesopotamian case, or at least in the Mesopotamian case over the same time period in the 3rd millennium BC, where for the most part, territorial control extended for less than 100 kilometers from the capital, from the city, and sometimes far less than 100 kilometers. Here in Egypt, the pharaoh and the bureaucracy and the administration had to control much larger areas. To a very great degree, this unification and this control was facilitated by the ease of transportation and movement along the Nile. Almost all of Egypt was within reach of the Nile. Communities were only a few kilometers away from the Nile in ways that simply was not the case in Mesopotamia. So the ease of communication on the Nile certainly played a part in the successful integration of the Egyptian state. But that integration also involved the successful spread of an ideology of rule that linked the social and spiritual health of the Nile Valley and its inhabitants with the person of the ruler, the pharaoh. The pharaoh was seen first as having supernatural powers over, or perhaps more accurately, a supernatural identity with the Nile and its floods. The pharaoh guaranteed the well-being of the state through his own individual vitality and efforts. He maintained the balance of social and supernatural forces that ordered the world, in contrast to the chaos that could come from the supernatural world or from foreign lands. While most pharaohs were male, and the symbolism and ideology of Egyptian royalty remained explicitly male throughout, some Egyptian rulers were women, commencing probably with Meretnet in the first dynasty, probably just after 3000 BC. So there's a possibility of female rule in a way that did not exist in Mesopotamia. This was a very different justification for rule than did exist in contemporary Mesopotamia, where particular gods were seen as essentially owners of the communities. It was the gods who were significant in the life of the communities, with the priest and the rulers acting as their human representatives. And in fact, what we see in Mesopotamia in the 3rd millennium BC is, if anything, a secularization of political power in a way that doesn't really happen at all in Egypt. In fact, in Egypt, something of the reverse, an elaboration of this identity, this supernatural identity of the ruler with the state. In Mesopotamia, the ruler still rules with the sanction of the gods, but increasingly, through the third millennium BC, gets further and further away from any assumption of divinity himself. The Egyptian case, in both its political and religious circumstances, implies that the whole land of Egypt was in some sense owned by the pharaoh. And indeed, we also see evidence here for far greater centralization of economic control in Egypt than in Mesopotamia. So that this ownership was not merely theoretical, was not merely ritual, was not merely ideological. There was a great centralization of the economy in the pharaoh, in the court, and in the bureaucracy that reported directly to the pharaoh. This is really quite elaborate. It was a real command economy. Much of the productive land along the Nile seems to have been in the hands of large estates controlled directly by the pharaoh's household, by households of high nobles, many related to the pharaoh, or, again, as in Mesopotamia, by the temples. Production and allocation of resources was under control of an elaborate, multi-tiered bureaucracy. This would not necessarily have involved telling farmers what or when to plant. That was still under local control. But, for example, this bureaucracy probably played a significant role in deciding the distribution and storage of harvests. It certainly oversaw public works. As in Mesopotamia, temples played a large role in the economy, in the storage, distribution of resources. The relatively rural nature of Egyptian society, vis-a-vis that of Mesopotamia, probably meant that there was comparatively less demand for excess foodstuffs than in the more urban areas along the Tigris and Euphrates. One significant difference between the two areas is that in Egypt, the irrigation systems did develop through the dynastic period, but they, in part because of the characteristics of the Nile and the Nile floods, usually remained relatively simple and under local control compared to Mesopotamia. The great exception to this was the vast state irrigation system around the Fayum Depression, an area I've already mentioned, west of the Nile, in the early second millennium BC. And here the state was involved. This was can be seen almost as a state mega project. This very large-scale system of canals and irrigation ditches was used to provide water from the lake that still existed there in the Fayum in dynastic times, and also to lower lake levels so that the fertile lands around the lake could be reclaimed. Trade and market systems were not nearly as developed in dynastic Egypt as they were in Mesopotamia. There's nothing, absolutely nothing, like even the Uruk trading network from the 4th millennium BC. There certainly was trade, both internal trade up and down the Nile, and also significant degrees of trade into other areas beyond Egypt, into the Levant, as far away as Anatolia, with Cyprus, with Crete, and further to the south, into Sudan, even with Ethiopia, along the Red Sea. But this trade was very frequently, most often controlled by representatives of the pharaoh or of the temples, and again seems for the most part to have been associated with the state control of distribution. Now, real contrasts in the economic life of Egypt vis-a-vis Mesopotamia. But let's go back to the issue of the ideology of rule for a moment. Because this is, I think, particularly significant. The identification in Egypt between the person of the ruler and the fortunes of the community is also known from more recent ethnographic cases along the Nile as among Funj and Shilluk populations in what's now Sudan, further to the south along the Nile in the historic period. This preoccupation with the vitality of the ruler as supernaturally connected to the vitality of the community, the state as a whole. In some cases, in other areas of the Nile Valley, not in Egypt, but in other areas of the Nile Valley, and in more recent periods, the 19th, early 20th century, this traditionally went as far as killing the ruler when he displayed any bodily infirmity, because sickness or the weakness associated with old age would imply infirmity for the state as a whole, which would certainly take a lot of the fun out of being king. These are present-day populations living in southern Sudan, with Shilluk, for example, people having a greater pastoralist orientation than do Funj communities, which are now also heavily assimilated to Arab culture. There are a variety of different cultural populations, pastoralist and otherwise, living in southern Sudan. And, of course, then one question is, what was the nature of relationships up and down the Nile beyond the direct control of the Egyptian state during the dynastic period? Archaeologists and ethnographers have argued for a century about whether there are any connections between these far more recent examples of this identification between ruler and state and that of ancient Egypt. It seems very doubtful to me that there are any direct connections over a period of 4,000 years, at least. It may be, in part, that there's a very general cultural milieu in this part of northeastern Africa along the Nile Valley where these ideas are occasionally drawn out, but without any direct historical link. It may be that the importance of the river itself encourages these kind of metaphorical connections between the king and the state. During the 3rd millennium BC, this identification between pharaoh and state would become steadily more elaborated. The pharaoh was the personification on earth of the hawk god Horus. You remember, in my last lecture, when I talked about the palette of Narmer, I noted that it had been found at that site, Nekin, the city of the hawk, the city of Horus. And the pharaoh was ultimately the personification of the sun god, Ra, who divided day from night and battled the forces of chaos in the universe. After death, the pharaoh would take his place in the divine pantheon, watching over Egypt and the vital identification between ruler and ruled. Pharaoh and state would pass to a successor. This implied, as well as we can imagine, particular care for the body of the ruler after death, which was already a general aspect of religious belief in Egyptian society. The body would be mummified at death, but it still needed to be protected. Mummification is a process that we see even going back into the pre-dynastic period. People were buried to the west of the Nile in the desert. That is where the sun sets. It's the land of the dead. In the pre-dynastic, we have some examples of mummification as a natural process. And in fact, it's hard to say when exactly the elaborations that we see associated with Middle Kingdom mummification and later mummification, the sorts of elaborate processes of mummification we see, for example, with King Tutankhamun, developed. However, given this ideology of the pharaoh as personification of the Nile and of Egypt, it's not really a surprise that some of the most striking physical manifestations of classical Egyptian culture are, of course, its royal tombs. The pyramids of Giza, dating to the middle of the 3rd millennium BC, are perhaps the most famous archaeological remains in the world. They were conceived of in Egyptian royal ritual as a divine mountain from which the pharaoh could ascend into heaven after death. They were built as well to protect the sepulcher and the body of the pharaoh, and of course to provide an awe-inspiring vision of the power of the ruler and of the Egyptian state. Archaeologists have also suggested that the pyramids had a more prosaic function as well, to knit together the multitude of Egyptian communities scattered up and down the Nile in a single communal effort for the glorification of the pharaoh and of the state. Workers from all over the country took part in this communal labor in seasons when agricultural tasks were minimal, and during the time that they worked, they received rations, which were gathered in as taxation from across the country from the state. The Giza pyramids are thus a much more striking symbol of redistribution and governance than are the bevel-rimmed bowls found on contemporary Mesopotamian sites. They're also more beautiful. But the bevel-rimmed bowls and the pyramids had the same purpose, to weld the populations to the institution and rulers of states that had only just become unified. Pyramids and bevel-rimmed bowls. Egypt was a bigger state. Perhaps it needed bigger symbols. Over the period between 3100 and 332 BC, there would be a remarkable continuity in the forms and ideologies of state rule in Egypt. This system of thinking about the ruler and the ruler's place in the state, in Egypt, and in the world as a whole was evidently a very successful one. It lasted. It persisted. It was useful in some way. Even foreign usurpers, and there were some, assumed the role of pharaoh when they sought to rule the Egyptian state. That, like many things in Egypt, doesn't seem to have changed. Next time, I want to talk in a little bit more detail about comparisons, the various characteristics of Egyptian and Mesopotamian civilization during their respective dynastic periods. Thank you very much.